I guess many of you who are here tonight were also at the African Studies seminar last week, when the theme of the talk was the transition from ethnic clientelistic parties to programmatic parties. I think it was Nick who gave the talk that time. Ethiopia is a very interesting example of what I see an ethnic programmatic party, if you can use that label. Ethiopia, the ruling party, the Ethiopian Revolutionary Democratic Front, EPRDF, started off with an ideologically motivated mobilization in the 1970s against the military Marxist junta of the Derg, through the mobilization of the Tigray People's Liberation Front in 1975. At that time, they were convinced, very highly inspired by Stalin, that ethnicity was the way of mobilizing people in transforming Ethiopia. Ethnicity was the way to mobilize the community to neutralize possible separatist movements after coming to power and foster unity and integration. And so it was not only an instrumental use, I mean, it was an instrumental use of ethnicity, but not in the way that you can see in many other African countries where ethnicity is sort of underground, but still very much active in politics. This talk, as David mentioned, is based on this book that was published last year at Brill, and that's also based on my dissertation in political science. And it deals with, it started off with my own interest in the relatively or quite unique system of ethnic federalism that has been implemented in Ethiopia since 1991. As far as I have managed to find out, there are no other constitutions today that gives ethnic groups the right to self-determination, including an up to secession, but Ethiopia does. And I wanted to understand what goes on the ground when such a system is implemented. What kind of impact does it have on the relationship between ethnic groups, within ethnic groups, on the relationship between the local and regional administration and up to the national level? I can send this book around if you want to have a look. The 1995 Constitution of Ethiopia, in Article 39, it says that every nation, nationality, and people have the right to self-determination up to and including secession. In Ethiopia, you don't use the label ethnic groups. You use the label nations or nationalities or peoples. And this is a labeling that's been directly imported from Stalin's Russia. Throughout the time when this system has been implemented, you can actually see that yes, there has been situation moving from large scale state destabilizing ethnic conflicts to a situation of relative stability. But on the local level, within the different communities in Ethiopia, there has been an upsurge of ethnic conflicts, and there has been a sharpening of the lines between ethnic groups. If you just look at the map, if you can see the map, you can see that after 1991, Ethiopia was divided into 11 different regional states. Two states are very small, they are almost like city-states, Diredawa and Harar. And then you have regional states, which are supposed to be made on the basis of ethnic lines. But of course, with 80 different ethnic groups within the country, it's impossible to give all of them a regional state. So, for example, this region here in the southern corner here, the Southern Nations Nationalities and Peoples Regional State, it's a very, very, very long name. The Southern region, in short, it includes 56 different ethnic groups. While, for example, the Somali region, the Afar region, and the Tigray region are quite homogeneous regions. All these regions had, per constitution, the right to have their own executive, their own legislative power, their own judicial power, and they also had the right to be represented in Addis Ababa in the national government. These two principles, self-government and representation in the national government, are the crucial principles of federalism in political science. So on paper, Ethiopia is definitely a federation. But these structures contradict another very basic structure in Ethiopia, and that is the centralized party system. EPRDF is a very centralized organization, and through different affiliated parties, through different member parties, it is controlling the every regional state in Ethiopia. And if there are situations where the interest of the party is at stake, they will definitely overrule their regional government's right to govern their own affairs. And this has clearly been happening. You know, that is the really the rule of the game in Ethiopia since 1991. So whether it's a real federation is really a matter of controversy. Yes, this book that I'm just sending around now is including two quite in-depth case studies of two ethnic groups in the southern region of Ethiopia, the Wolaita and the Sidama. In the southern region, particularly, you have seen number of conflicts labeled as ethnic has increased, and a number of groups who previously were not defined as ethnic groups have been coming up with the demands that we are ethnic groups, we should have our own administration. And so there have been new administrative units coming up in the aftermath of introducing this system, while in other areas it's clear that where the interest of the ruling party has contradicted with establishing new administrative units, ethnic groups who clearly were ethnic groups haven't had the chance to have their own administrations. So it's clear that you cannot understand what's going on in Ethiopia today without taking into consideration the interest of the ruling party in maintaining and consolidating its control of the regions. If we just go back a bit and look at the context that federal system, the background before ethnic federalism was introduced in 1991, you can see that Ethiopia has a prehistory of ethnic strife. Throughout the history of the Ethiopian state, you've had a culture of ethnic rank and hierarchy, of suspicion across ethnic groups, of the Amhara, the highlanders in the Amhara. The Amhara group has been the state-building elite, and their faith, Christian Orthodox faith, and the Amhara language has been the precondition for being able to take any sort of positions within the Ethiopian state. And accompanying the hegemony of the Amhara culture, you have had feudal-like system of where Amhara landlords, when the Ethiopian state was expanding to the peripheries, were given land in their newly incorporated areas and got the local people under, they were the subordinates. And if people in the newly incorporated areas wanted to, you know, get any influence, they had to be baptized as Orthodox Christians and they had to take the Amhara identity, Amhara language. So there has been some, there have been incorporation and subjugation, but also some sort of assimilation here. The two groups that I was looking at in my book, they are situated in the highlands of the southern region. Let me just see. I'm not sure if any help from you, but anyway. This is the southern region. My two groups are the Wolaitas and the Sidamas. You can't see, but anyway. They are the two largest groups by population in the southern region, although their areas are not that large. Both of these groups had their own traditional political structures before they were incorporated into the Ethiopian Empire by the end of the 1800s. Let me just wind back a little bit and then talk about what I wanted to say about in the political science approach to institutions, what kind of government you should have in multi-ethnic states has, you know, been very much focused on the design of institutions. What kind of institutional frameworks should be there in order to mitigate ethnic conflict? In the literature on federalism, on whether it should be ethnic-based or not, there is a clear division between those who argue that if federations are ethnic-based, it will lead to more ethnic conflicts. On the other hand, you have those who say that when ethnic groups have their own administrations, conflict will be mitigated. In these institutional approaches, it is difficult to see ethnic groups as anything else than homogeneous units who speak with more than one voice. They are seen as one group is one political unit, and that's it. In my studies of Wolaita and Sidama, I clearly see that this is not the case. And ethnic conflict is in many ways not only expressions of inter-ethnic conflicts, but also conflicts within groups. So in line with the constructivist approach, ethnic groups are not seen as homogeneous. They are constellations of different interest groups, of traditional hierarchies, social strata, generation and gender lines. And that, of course, has an impact on how the system of ethnic federalism is negotiated, understood, implemented on the ground in these societies. And equally important as the institutional frameworks are the informal political games here. The power games of the ruling party and the relations and the contestations and the past and the present between the various ethnic groups and between subgroups within these communities. And I think if you look at the Africanist tradition of political science, this is quite thoughts that are quite welcomed and understood. Political institutions have to be seen in the context of history and culture. that cannot be understood apart from that. And it also gives a strong message to policymakers and others who think that you can export institutions easily from one context to the other and get the same outcome. So then we can go back to the two groups that I selected for studies. Wolaita, this is the group in the middle here. They have had serious conflicts both to other ethnic groups and to the regional administration in the regional center of Awassa through during the period of time when this system has been implemented. The conflict level really escalated at the point of time when the ruling party and the regional and national government tried to enforce a new language in this area in 1998. Wolaita shares many linguistic similarities with surrounding groups, Gamogofa and Dawra particularly. And on the basis of this, the ruling party wanted to introduce a new language that was constructed on the basis of these four groups. And they called it Uwagagoda. That means Wolaita, Gamogofa, and Dawro. And they wanted to do this because at that point of time, these four groups or five groups were administered in the same, under the same administrative unit, the North Omo. And then they wanted to sort of, you know, the ruling party in the EPRF has the idea that ethnic identities are somehow primordial, but they're also possible to manipulate them, and they are flexible. And they can be used for political purposes. In this context, it was useful for the ruling party to have a unified North Omo identity, and then they created this language. That was, of course, leading to very strong reactions, particularly from the Wolaitas. And that is related to the fact that this group has been an independent kingdom until it was incorporated in Wolaita, in the Ethiopian Empire, at the end of the 1800s. The Sidama, they have a quite different history. They have been administered by different clans, the decentralized political structure. But they have still had strong conflicts with the regional government because they claim we are a big ethnic group. We are almost as large as the Tigrayans who are dominating the EPRF today, and we should have our own region. And Awassa, the regional capital of the southern region, is on Sidama land. And then there have been controversies on who should actually have the right to administer Awassa. Is it the regional government or is it the Sidamas? And on top of this, you have had a conflict between the Wolaitas in Sidamas, in the borderlands here in the south, along a lake called Abaya, where Sidama pastoralists on one side and Wolaita farmers on the other have been fighting on where the border is. As I will come back to later, it's clear that the introduction of ethnic federalism has exacerbated these sort of conflicts. Conflicts that were before defined on the basis of livelihood are now purely based on ethnic identities. It's not about farmers against pastoralists anymore. It's about Wolaitas against Sidamas. And this also makes conflicts probably more difficult to solve and more complex, as it involves not only the people in the area, but it can mobilize the whole group standing behind each of the parties in the conflict. So I still have another slide, which can maybe just, you can't see it, but anyway, I will just use it as a starting point for describing the, you know, the basis of comparing these two cases. As I just briefly said, Sidama was governed by a decentralized union of clans before the Ethiopian Empire included Sidama, while Wolaita was a centralized kingdom with a divine king, Tona, until 1897. And in Sidama, you had clans that were living side by side, but territorially concentrated. In Wolaita, they were dispersed all over. They were mixed. Both Wolaita and Sidama have marginalized groups of artisans, potters, smiths, who are not included in the main clan system and are not allowed to live in the areas where other people live. And they're not allowed to intermarry, they are seen as impure and so on. In Wolaita, you have an additional group of stigmatized people, that is the ex-slaves, or the those who have had ex-slaves as their forefathers. This is still a valid category in Wolaita today. In Sidama, these marginalized groups, especially one potter group called the Hadicho, had their own land, compared to in Wolaita, where they had no land, they had to live by other means, or they were allowed to live outside the settled villages. In Sidama, because of the decentralized union of clans, they did not manage to coordinate resistance against the Ethiopian empire when they came to incorporate the Sidamas at the end of the 19th century. So there was a relatively peaceful submission there. While in Wolaita, you had centralized and coordinated resistance. And history says that it took 7 years before Menelik managed to depose Tona, the king. And it was relatively bloody. When you come to the time when the Derg was in power, from 1974 to 1991, the Sidamas, quite contrary to what happened when the Ethiopian Empire came, managed to organize a unified Liberation Front, the Sidama Liberation Front. From 1975, quite in parallel with TPLF, it organized resistance. It had bases in Somalia, and it was trying to make up an armed resistance against the Derg. While in Wolaita, on the other hand, there was no such resistance, no attempt of organizing any front. It was just, you know, organization of self-help organizations underground who tried to mobilize on a very low level. And one of the reasons why I think Sidama people managed to organize or wanted to organize a liberation front is probably because they had a growing cash crop economy of coffee, and they had a relatively good amount of land for each farmer. They wanted to live on their land. While in Wolaita, it was not enough land. People went out from their communities into Awassa to the state farms and were spread all over the southern region. So they did not have the same interest in defending their own territory. When you come to what happened under ethnic federalism, you have, again, a very opposite result and outcome. In Sidama, the mobilization against the regional governments, when there have been conflicts, had actually been divided. While in Wolaita, it has been a cohesive struggle. Why is this happening? It's quite surprising when you see that Sidama Liberation Front was active against the Derg and has been also trying to mobilize during the time of the EPRDF. If you're going to explain this, you have to look at the interest of the ruling party combined with the history of the Sidama society. The Sidama region, the Sidama zone, and the Sidama people is, as I said, the largest ethnic group in the south. It is not in the interest of the ruling party to have a united Sidama group mobilizing against the central and the regional government. In the Sidama history, you have sources of division. You have the Hadichos having their own land, being relatively more empowered than the marginalized groups in Wolaita. And this could be played upon by the EPRDF. The EPRDF had their own representative in Awassa for the most part of the 1990s, TPLF cadre called Bita Ubelai. He was very active in mobilizing the Hadicho people to establish their own political party, the Hadicho Democratic, I can't remember exactly the name. And so the Hadicho people, they did not want to be a part of the regular Sidama ethnic mobilization. And they could manage to organize by the help of the ruling party, but also because of the fact that they have been one unit that have had their own land compared to in Wolaita. If you look at the history of the Wolaitas, they certainly have a legacy to draw upon from the centralized kingdom before they were incorporated into the Ethiopian Empire. And this legacy has been actively used to mobilize resistance against the introduction of the Wogogada language in 1999. At that point of time, it was some representatives of the ex-slave groups, which everybody knows, but nobody talks about it. Everybody knows who they are. They were very much in favor of this language. They saw it as this will end the privileged status of the old king clans. This will help us to get positions and to be privileged as a group. So we want the Wogoda language, we want to undermine the specific Wolaita culture. We want to be unified with the others. So they became the scapegoats in this struggle. And through this struggle against the language, the very old prestigious clans managed to mobilize and managed to monopolize the definition of what a Wolaita is. And therefore, there appeared a common front of the Wolaita people. I don't know how much time I have left.
About 15 minutes left.
Yes. So, if we look at the very different patterns of ethnic mobilization in these two societies, it is quite clear to see that the very same political institutions, the institutional framework, creates very different outcomes, even in such a small area that this represents. And then it is also, it gives a hint to the institutional approach that is very hard to predict outcomes. Introduce this system of institutions, then you get this outcome. That's quite far from reality in most policies, I guess. We can see that in both communities, the leaders there, they relied on ethnic markers to mobilize the people. But the intra-ethnic conditions, clan competition, social stratification, each group's relation to the neighbors and to the ruling party were all important in shaping the ethnic political mobilization there. You can see that, yes, there have been increased ethnic mobilization, but in very different ways. There have been, in both communities, a revival of tradition, very much in the same way as you saw during colonial rule, where indirect rule was making ethnic entrepreneurs reinventing tradition in order to gain material resources and administration, administrative resources during colonial time. In Wolaita, as I said, traditional elites have managed to mobilize the interpretation of Wolaita history, and they have enforced a moral order and definition of Wolaita identity. This is has a very clear parallel to what John Lonsdale is talking about in Kenya, the concept about moral ethnicity, where he's saying that in a way, ethnic identities are primordial because they rely on common, very common, clearly identifiable traits. But on the other hand, in the process of defining ethnic groups, there are conflict between different interests within these groups. In Kenya, it resulted in the imposition of conservatism, of authoritarian conservatism by the traditional elite. In Wolaita, it resulted in imposition of the Wolaita culture defined by the traditional elites also, in a way, excluding the ex-slaves and the marginalized artisan groups. In Sidama, the traditionally marginalized, they took up their own struggle, supported by the interests of the ruling party, and they mobilized separately, apart from the established elites. And the Hadicho's success in organizing a separate struggle reflects the historical conditions of the marginalized group in Sidama, but of course also the current politics of IPDF. So, coming back to not seeing groups as homogeneous, both Sidama and Wolaita are clear cases of ethnic conflicts, not as only expressions of struggles between groups, but also intra-ethnic conflicts. In both Wolaita and Sidama, you have seen a revival of clan identities. It's not now anymore just to ask, are you a Wolaita or Sidama? It's also very important to know which clan you belong to. During the Derg time, this was not really something to talk about. It was rather suppressed at that time. Now it is revived, and it becomes very important part of local politics in these areas. The downside of this is, of course, also that the discrimination against the artisan groups and the ex-slaves have also been more, it's easier to justify. And also practices that are important ethnic markers for the Wolaitis in the Sidamas. Many of them are also are also sort of maintaining discrimination against not only potters and ex-slaves, but also women. It's the men in the prestigious clans that are benefiting from the revival of tradition. Those elements of, you know, Bulaita and Sidama culture who could have empowered women are not really those who are revived. So even though numbers of, even though there have been a very active campaign from the government side to stop female circumcision, the ethnic politics has certainly not helped to stop or to reduce the number of circumcision, because it's an important marker for ethnic groups. And the same with marriage by abduction. I remember an anecdote when the first president of the southern region came to power. There was a talk about we should abandon the custom of abducting wives. And then he said, now we have ethnic federalism. We have a right to determine our own affairs. This is a part of our culture. We should be allowed to do that. So revival of tradition has two sides here, definitely. And as I just mentioned also about the Abaya conflict along the lake between the pastoralists and the farmers, it's an indication of also that ethnic politics and ethnic-based federalism is leading to sharper lines between ethnic groups. When you're going to give every ethnic group their right to their own administration, you also have to decide where the borders are. So borders that in the past have been very flexible and fluid and have not been delineated at all, they have to be set, because that is what matters when each group should have their own administration. So conflicts along livelihood lines are now ethnic, and that is, you can see that in many places around, in similar studies in Somali region and other places in the south of Ethiopia. So, yes, 5 minutes, okay. So, if we look at the prospects or the potential of ethnic-based solutions in multi-ethnic states, I think, of course, as my book is illustrating, you can't understand political mobilization in Ethiopia only because of introduction of federal ethnic-based federalism. But I think definitely you can say that a system based on ethnic lines will inherently be unstable and is and that is linked to the nature of the social phenomenon of ethnicity. It is a fluid and flexible phenomenon. Originally, when you are giving ethnicity such a prominent role in politics, then this flexibility is very hard to maintain. So there will be always new claims of ethnic administrations coming up, and there will be also sharpening of ethnic lines. So this points to the inherent unstable nature of ethnic-based solutions in multi-ethnic states. So I think that will be the conclusion, and then I'm opening up questions.